You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Philip Metris. He's talking to me from Ohio. Philip, thanks so much for being with me today.
I'm very glad to be joining you today. Thanks.
Philip, I know we're going to be talking about your poetry, and you'll be reading a little bit, but just to jump into your practice, what are you working on now? Is there, I imagine it's a few things, or what's happening right now for you?
I'm working on a number of different projects. I find that each project occupies a slightly different part of my mental capacity and my imagination. And I like to switch, actually, between them, because when I hit a wall somewhere, I just move into another room and find a new way in. But the thing that's really been obsessing me for about 3 years is a memoir project. It's now called The More You Love the Motherland, and it's a memoir essentially about my time living in Russia during the transition to a capitalist economy back in 1992 and 93, studying Russian poetry and discovering, much to my chagrin, that the great mythology about the power of a Russian poet was diminishing in the face of pop culture and inflation and the new sort of democratic changes. So that's been a really interesting project because, you know, as you know, most of my work has been in poetry, and this has been an exciting kind of beginner's mind project for me.
That's exciting. And so just I want to ask you to go on about other projects, but that's a memoir about those specific years when you were in Russia. Is that the case?
That's right. And I toggle actually back and forth between like a present tense moment of going on a reading tour with a Russian poet in the States and then casting back, remembering various moments of my time there and sort of thinking about what Russia looked like to me with my young American eyes and what America looks like through this Russian poet's eyes, who was a kind of mentor and guide to me, named Sergei Gomelsky.
And what other projects are you working on? So that's one, your memoir, but there's a few other things happening.
Yeah, absolutely. I have a book coming out in the fall. It's called The Sound of Listening, Poetry as Refuge and Resistance. And it's a gathering of a number of essays I've been writing for the last 10 years, sort of about poetics, art, and the role it can play in our lives. And the nutshell version is, you know, I wrote a dissertation and a book that came out a number of years ago about poetry and its intersection with the peace movement. And I was fascinated by the way in which poets both had this dialogue with the peace movement and also kind of resisted some of its claims, which is to say that they wanted to create a space for the imagination, a refuge from simply the political life. And that's kind of that feeling that I had, that art has to play a very particular role in creating spaces, not that are apolitical, but spaces where a politics can begin and a being can happen in new ways. So I'm looking at various writers, and particularly some of the Russian writers that I translated, as well as writers doing things like documentary poetics, writers doing installation work, doing poetry in the landscape like graffiti and that sort of thing, and just trying to create spaces for expanding our idea of what poetry is and how it can sort of help us reconceive, ways of being in the world.
That's so interesting. That sounds kind of so broad. I mean, it seems that would be hard to keep it within, boundaries clear enough to be able to write it. I mean, you were talking about Russia. Just when you mentioned that last, I know you were just talking about it in a nutshell, but mm-hmm. in terms of how it gets out and the role of poetry, and when you talked about living in Russia and how you were, dismayed to see that pop culture was kind of edging in on the mythical territory that you thought Russian poets had, In this book that you're talking about, isn't that also part of the issue, too, of how it gets out into culture, how Or is it more the overtones? Like, we're not talking strictly poetry, we're talking also about installations and other artists using poetic elements.
That's a really good question. So one of the things I don't want to do in the book is to guard the boundaries of what poetry is as a genre, and more talk about the way we can operate with language as a mode of art, you know, of art. And so that's part of it is very experimental in that sense, is trying to redefine our, you know, the somewhat narrow bounds we place around poetry, and to open it up a little bit without losing a sense that, of course, there is something called a poem, and that it might operate and function with certain, you know, with certain laws. But, you know, great poems seem to me great because their language is irreducible in some way and not simply communicable as a moral or as some simple theme or idea. And I think that's true of all the arts and of all these kind of manifestations of poetry, that they enable us to encounter a certain kind of mystery. And so that's what the book is. It's a lot of fun because I don't feel like the book is principally a kind of scholarly endeavor. I really wanted to, as an artist, you know, invite people to rethink the boundaries they placed around poetry.
Well, and that includes what is poetic, right? I mean, I ask because so often visual artists talk about poetics in the sense of, I mean, there's a number of ways they talk about them, of course, but that it would be nice if an exhibition was referred to as something poetic. But it seems that that's something, it seems that that's hard to craft. It's like wishing that your poem was magical, or that some expression you did was, you know, I mean, for lack of a better comparative term, but that it's not something that you can craft or control so much as a visual artist. It's something, let's say, an exhibit that it has a poetic overtone or is poetic as a descriptor isn't something that you can kind of produce. It's something that's a value judgment by the viewers, as opposed to the way a poet can enter into it, which is you write a poem.
Right. I guess that, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, obviously we live in an age where all of these definitions are really slippery. And we spoke earlier about some of your performative, your performance art pieces, which can be as direct as, you know, one person hugging another person, which in a certain context is just a hug, but in the context of an art space and with artists doing it, becomes imbued with this other kind of magic, actually, as you mentioned, something different. Just that awareness of something happening that might have some meaning other than itself.
Right, right. Leaving that possibility open.
Right.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
And so, The Sound of Listening, your memoir, and just to go through anything else you're working on before you read a poem, what else are you working on?
I'll just name one more, and that is finishing up a revision of a book that will come out in 2020 called Shrapnel Maps, and that is a set of poems and long poems investigating and considering and thinking about what some people call the Holy Land or Israel or Palestine. I had the opportunity to go there. My sister married a man in the Palestinian man in the West Bank, and just thinking about this contested place and the histories there, and wanting to bring my language to it in some way. The series of poems in the book. It sort of look at different aspects or elements. One thing I'm doing in there is looking at old maps and meditating on the way in which the land is imagined, particularly from a kind of European point of view, where there's a certain sort of projection or fantasy on it. And another part is about this wedding. It's sort of a long poem kind of about the experience of being there in this little village with a couple thousand people celebrating this marriage. Another section is about a bombing told from the points of view of, you know, it's a fictional bombing, but I take language and, you know, experiences from people who, you know, are, who live there. And another part's about a refugee from Jaffa who left in 1948, and she's just a local Cleveland woman, and just had these amazing conversations with her, and wanted to kind of figure out a way of telling her story in poetry. So that's been a project that's 10 years in the making, you know, given the inflammatory nature of any narrative around that situation, place, conflict. I wanted to take my time and not rush into something that wouldn't speak to the kind of the real complexity there. So that's been an interesting project.
That sounds interesting to say the least. It's you know, as you were saying before, a little bit about poetics and artist's role and politics and peace. This all fits into that book, right? It's also the challenge of being able to write about that. I mean, you know, half my family anyway is Jewish, and some are in Israel, and you know that's an endless argument that's almost untouchable.
Right.
You know?
Right.
I mean, it's like, you know, I mean, of course, the people that you know feel that Israel is wrong, which, you know, what they're doing, their aggression, which I'm on the side of, can talk to me, and the ones that don't, it's like almost as impossible. And enormously kind of divisive and violent discussion over those issues.
Right. Yeah. So and there are, in a sense, many truths that you know, that are proved with flesh and blood, and that's part of the problem, is that all the stories we tell are sort of are true in the lowercase t, but they're, you know, there's, is there some way of making our truths or our narratives more porous to the other? That's the question that I would that I'm trying to investigate or invite myself into, you know, as an Arab American and my reader into. So that's the challenge, for sure.
That is a challenge, and I'm so glad you set that for yourself. I look forward to that book. So let's jump into some of your writing. I'd love to hear a poem, whatever you have for us there.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that now that I've talked this up, I thought maybe I should read something from it. So this is from the section of Shrapnel Maps that kind of goes between these the maps themselves and sort of writing about the maps and incidents in our neighborhood. I live in a predominantly Jewish Orthodox neighborhood outside Cleveland, and it's just amazing and beautiful in many ways to see a community that has such great faith and organizes its life around God, in a sense, and yet at the same time there have been moments where I felt, you know, like an outsider. And this is one of those moments, sort of navigating or negotiating these experiences. So this is the poem. It's untitled, part of the sequence, Shrapnel Maps. My neighbor's handshake is firm, his black kippahs clipped to his scalp, edges ruffling in the wind. With plastic rake, I'm scaring the final evidence of fall from my drive, trying to understand why my daughter asked for a new friend, one who doesn't say she's goy, who will let her come inside to play. His smile winces. My wife, he says, she grew up only around our kind. I look away, not wanting to salt his pain. I think we're generous to others, he says, trying to explain. Not like the Arabs. In his face, I see the red-headed kid at a West Bank checkpoint, my father, my Arab father, engaged in conversation. You're from Brooklyn. What are you doing here? Each of them could have asked the other. My checkered keffiyeh hangs in the closet, visible only to me. White flakes descend. He talks around the awkwardness. I scrape the last dead leaves. The Arab in me still wants to invite him in for tea. The American in me wants the Arab to turn and disappear, in the falling snow.
Very beautiful. Thank you for that. Well, I think that poem does get at a little bit what you're saying. That's a bit of the intention of what you were talking about, right? Trying to translate your truth or another person's truth.
It's tricky. It's very tricky. Yeah, but that's that. You know, I'm hoping to. It's funny because I went into this project and the previous, you know, long kind of political work, sand opera, mostly focusing on other sources, using documents and testimony and that sort of thing. But what at the end of the day, I feel that I need to also stand in the ground of my own experience, and I think that poem tries to do that, to both be listening and to be saying something that that has a kind of truth in itself, the authority of an experience, a lived experience.
Well, and as you're saying, listening to it also, you know, what I get from that also, right, is this experience, if that's what you mean, of actually listening to kind of the other, right, or another, and that in itself is very hard to kind of convey, because that seems to be the issue, right? It's very hard to listen, period.
It is. And particularly when you yourself are in pain or don't feel like you've been listened to. And I think that is one of the things that happens to people in conflict, is that they feel that they haven't been heard. And so it's very difficult to hear the other side's story, however legitimate it may be, when you yourself feel that you know your humanity or your dignity has not been accounted for or not been taken into trust.
Well, thank you for that one. I'd love to hear another one. I know you have a few more there. What is the next one you're reading?
Well, I thought I'd read something from Sand Opera. This is a poem that sort of speaks to, the sort of post 9/11 moment. It quotes a Russian poet named Ivan Zhdanov, who was the guy I met. There's a line from there, his poem that's in this poem. It's sort of about traveling after 9/11. As an Arab, I call it flying while Arab, and just feeling and seeing the distrust of other people about me, and not only about me, but about who they imagine I might be. And so this poem is from a sequence called Homefront, and it's fairly straightforward. On the flight overseas, the rows dotted with isolados, each an island of eyes. I was looking like Ivan Zhdanov. What outside is a cross, inside is a window. A white woman across the aisle eyed me the entire flight. Her gaze widened and neck craned as I, her eyes, slowly removed her eyes, my shoes. What could I say? Sometimes I'm afraid I'm carrying a bomb, that I'm a sleeper and don't know when I'll awaken. I should have said, identity isn't an end. It's a portal, a deportation from the country of mirrors, an inflection within a question, punctuation in the sentence between birth and birth. I said nothing. Later, visiting a Quaker meeting, I sat among scattered chairs. On the shores of breathing, all eyes shut, I waited. Silence our rudder, silence our harbor.
Thank you.
Sure.
Yeah, very beautiful poem. That one, and of course, quite different than the other. I'm not sure how to jump right into that one. Is there anything you want to say about that poem before we read another?
Just that, you know, the book Sand Opera is a kind of meditation of the period after 9/11, and particularly the Iraq War. There's a sequence about the Abu Ghraib prison scandal, and some poems about the war from various points of view, and poems for, you know, like watching my daughter sort of grow up in a time of war, and then kind of ends up with some poems about that go between my experience, my personal experience, and the experience of a certain detainee who was rendered into black sites, which were these secret prisons, which are these secret prisons that, you know, suspects were taken and interrogated in. So that part is sort of toward the end, when I'm sort of trying to talk a little bit more, you know, anchor the experience a little bit more in my own experience. And the difference, I think the main difference between the they were both prose poems. The main difference between this one and the previous one is this one approaches the idea of the story from kind of different angles. And that, so each sentence feels a little bit surprising sometimes relative to the previous one.
Well, there was also something, I mean, that you talked about in there, the idea of, you know, I might be carrying a bomb, or I might be asleep, or was how, I mean, I'm paraphrasing that awfully, but that it reminded me of a kind of an idea, and I don't know if this is what you meant, but that this idea of feeling guilty or part of something when you're not. Like, for example, I remember it was quite a long time ago, but I was living in Providence, and there was a murder behind my building. There was a body there or something, and the police were investigating and came up to my apartment and asked me a series of questions, and I was incredibly nervous. Like I felt like I was hiding something. You know what I mean? Like, did I see it? What didn't I see? What did I hear? What didn't I hear? And there was a kind of feeling, completely irrational, but that I am hiding something. You know what I mean? I don't know what that is, but I imagine I'm not alone in that. And I don't know if that's what you meant in there, but it reminded me of that kind of very strange feeling, which I don't know what that means, where you feel guilt for something that you had no part of and, you know, are not that, you know.
I wonder, yeah. I mean, I think that, in a sense, that revelation to me was something that when you identify with a group or you associate with a group, and someone from that group in that group is somehow considered a minority or marked in some way, that you feel some weird connection to them and to that. I mean, when you're talking about this murder, I think about, you know, what does it mean to be a man? You know, knowing that men perpetrate the vast majority of violent acts against people, you know? Mm-hmm. And so there's maybe that, you know, our eyes are both facing, you know, forward, because we know that we're predators, you know, we're from that kind of, you know, animal grouping and being a man on top of that. So, yeah, I think that for me it's sort of the internalized self-hatred or self-questioning sometimes, that feel like, well, you know, who am I exactly? And, you know, how much of me is myself and how much is just inherited? And it's partly making a joke, but it's not also. It's like we know what humans are capable of. And we also know that people who are demonized or, you know, considered less than human, you know, sometimes act that way because it's a script that that's hard to, you know, to counter constantly.
Right, a script that we're taught, that we grow up with, that we hear in the media. Yeah,
right.
Yeah, that's so interesting. So I'd love to hear one more. I think I have one more poem from us. I'm not sure where it's from.
Sure. Let's take something from pictures at an exhibition just to mix it up.
And then in that title, of course, I know from the Mussorgsky, did that title relate to that music or have anything to do with that?
Did. Utterly charmed by the pictures at an exhibition by Mussorgsky, and I actually heard it when I was living in Russia in St. Petersburg. And, you know, it's a it's a work of art that's very connected to Petersburg. And, you know, in writing this series of poems about the city, I wanted to find a way of, organizing what were kind of interesting poems, but didn't necessarily have a kind of structure, a kind of architecture. And what I found was that I'd loved the music, and so I looked at the music and started to match up poems to the different movements of pictures at an exhibition, the work, and that's what happened. So, I have a number of poems that might have to do with walking or sort of being a flaneur in a city, and of course, promenade is the repeated motif in pictures at an exhibition. And there's a piece called Gnomus or Gnome, which is, you know, this kind of very deformed-sounding piece, for lack of a better term. Mm-hmm. And so I tried to pick poems that were dealing with deformity or strangeness. And so it became a kind of organizing principle for the book, and was incredibly generative to work with that. So I have a couple poems. You tell me what you want to hear. I have a poem about sort of an encounter with a Roma or a gypsy, and I have a poem about a prison, like this a woman sort of giving sign language to someone in a prison. Which would you like to hear?
The gypsy. The encounter with the gypsy.
Hmm. Yeah, okay. So this is called When You Meet the Roma at the River. It's a promenade. When you meet the Roma at the river, your face translates for river and ever, translates your fate. Sign her your sins and ever forgive her. Sings she your sins. Pay her your pay for debtor's endeavor to spit in the river. Your sins will be and severed forever, spat into the river. Unlike the river, a mirror reflecting its framing forever, your sins will be just spit in the river. You'll probably live. And it's a poem, you know, working a kind of level of spell-like play, but the encounter, the story was very simple, is that the gypsy woman came up to me and you know, there she said, "Ti ne hitri, ti prastoi," which means you're not cunning, you're not too much of a intellect, you're a simple person, you're an open person. "Ti ne hitri, ti prastoi." She's like saying, You want my magic, basically, you know.
Right.
And I said, okay. So I said, you know, what do you want? And she said, I don't know. She wanted some number of rubles, and she spat in the river for my good luck, for my life, my good fortune. And I thought it was one of the best economic exchanges I've ever done in Russia. I felt better as a result. That's it.
Well, there's a very musical sound to that poem as well. It had a very kind of lovely song-like sound to it, to me.
Mm, thanks, yeah. Mm. That's what poems can do.
So before we go, I want to ask you what you're reading at the moment.
I'm reading a strange book called Irish on the Inside by Tom Hayden. One of the things that I've been exploring is writing a little bit about a program trip that I take students to Northern Ireland to study the peace process. And I, on my mom's side, am Irish, and just got really interested in the ways in which Irish in America, you know, are a certain way and have maybe been disconnected from kind of rebel tradition, the progressive tradition that exists there. And Tom Hayden, who is the guy, one of the architects of Students for Democratic Society and helped write the Port Huron Statement, really got kind of attached to reclaiming a sort of Irish progressivism. And it's his book kind of about his great anger and injustice, and locating that in the history of the Irish famine and and oppression that happened to Irish for hundreds of years under British rule. So it's just a really kind of interesting exploration, both personal and political, about one's identity and how it might inform a kind of advocacy of progressive politics.
And it sounds like that'll help with your next trip there, if you're traveling there again.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's a future writing project. I've started to do some pieces, but it's kind of thinking about the long road to peace and how both societies and people need to go through a kind of a long process of coming to terms with what's happened and moving into a new future. So that's my hope. I mean, I'm constantly, dealing with lost causes and difficult places. So it's just my just exactly my cup of tea.
Well, that's my hope too, and let's hope things come to fruition in the best possible way. Philip, thank you so much for talking with me today. I really appreciate your work and talking to you.
I really appreciate you reaching out and us having this conversation. Thank you so much.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.